Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham, and we're taking an extra shot of espresso in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Yeah, that's right. Our brilliant performance at Anfield in Roberto De Zerbi's first game in charge has been described as like Graham Potter football, but with five added espresso shots. Our quick start could and perhaps should have seen us out of sight before Liverpool got a foothold in the game. But a point away at Liverpool is nothing to sniff at. It was also a game that saw Leandro Trossard score the first Albion top-flight hat-trick for 42 years. Later on, we're going to hear from the last man to do it. So now our attention turns to Saturday's visit of Spurs to the Amex, where a victory could lift us up to third and with a game in hand. Joining me today as we look back on that brilliant performance at Anfield is, of course, Alan Wares. And we're delighted to welcome back Tom Hyland. And as I mentioned earlier, later on, we're here from Gordon Smith. But Tom, welcome back. It's lovely to see you again. And it was quite the game at the weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, great to be back on the show. And yeah, what a weekend to come on it after that game last week. I mean, what a performance that first 20 minutes. I mean, I was out of breath watching it.
let's bounce straight into this game then. I know AD likes to do the team lineup, but frankly, I mean, what was De Zerbi going to do? I mean, unless he was fancied throwing a grenade into the middle of it just to mark his appearance, I think it was always going to be as you were. So, but with that in mind, and given that, to be frank, in this country, De Zerbi is a little bit of an unknown quantity. Going into the game, Tom, what were your feelings? What did you, well, obviously you know what you were hoping for, but what did you think was going to happen?
To be honest, I think it was a real unknown going into it. For all of the talk beforehand of, you know, it's difficult, I'm not going to change anything, we'll carry on what Potter was doing. It kind of felt that, you know, he's going to add something there. And I think that unknown was kind of what surprised everyone in that first 20 minutes. I was surprised at how quick we came out of the blocks. And I think Liverpool were too. In terms of what I expected from the game, it wasn't that. I think, you know, being an Albion fan, probably slightly pessimistic, for draw at best, maybe lose. But going to Anfield, I think, you know, coming away with anything positive is a good result.
So, I mean, obviously, it was obviously a manic start. And, you know, just what everyone says, you know, first 20 minutes should have been 4-0 up and things like that. Now, that's the culmination of a good, fast start. But was there anything that you particularly noticed, given, obviously, having watched Potter for, you know, improve the side bit by bit by bit by bit over the past 3 years? Was there anything you particularly noticed that thought that's got De Zerbi's stamp on it already? Or did you just sort of like see, you know, the next instalment?
Yeah, I think there was a couple of things. You could see that he had the back three to work with the whole time that he's been there during the international break, because we played a lot more at the back. So we invited that pressure on from Liverpool and played through it. So whereas under Potter, we did play it at the back, obviously, but then naturally, once the pressure came on a bit too much, launched it forward. We didn't really do that at all, at least in the first half. And then the other side was definitely attacking. Was definitely more central. And there seemed to be more urgency to get the ball played into the box rather than playing around it. So I just think that there was that step up in intensity going forward that was noticeable as well. And whether that's kind of a result of playing that little bit more at the back and opening the space because the defence is pushed higher up and giving you that ability to kind of exploit that space. I don't know, but those were the two kind of key things, especially with March and Leo cutting inside a lot more. You know, they were driving through the middle and looking for those flick-ons. So they were really playing through the line.
Yeah, I mean, those are two players that the Zerbi was actually like highlighted before the game as players he thinks he can actually get the most out of. And I mean, it was obviously it was a magnificent performance from Leo, three goals. But I mean, it was a team performance of which Solly was a major part as well. And, you know, two assists for him. It's going to be a work in progress. And now he's got the whole week to work with the squad.
Exactly that. And, you know, as I say, you could tell that he had had the defence to work with longer. The likes of Trossard, they had only been in training, one day with him before. Yes, there had been messages whilst they're on international duty, but it's exciting to see what he can get out of those players in the future when he has more time, when his English gets better, although actually his English seems to have improved remarkably from his first press conference to his post-game.
That's a trip to Donatello's. That's what it will do to you.
That's why they went back.
Yeah. So, I mean, before he came, there was an element of those who knew him saw him that he's a kind of a great attacking fella, but, you know, is a little bit sort of kamikaze, a little bit leaky at the back. Now, obviously, Liverpool scored three, but then they're capable of doing so. And listening to Johnny Cantor and Warren Aspinall on the radio for the commentary, it certainly seems that after we went 2-0 up, Liverpool changed it round a little bit and we were getting a bit sloppy. Now, was that a classic Brighton sloppy, or was that, do you think there was an element of the De Zerbi tactics not working? I mean, I'd appreciate that's a subtle nuance for you to answer, but, you know, did you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think there was that kind of period of the game where suddenly we're not getting the second ball, suddenly our passes are going a bit awry, and that kind of general sloppiness that we sometimes see just before half time or just after scoring a goal normally. The one area that I think we maybe gave Liverpool a bit too much was out wide. So I think the wing backs, whilst they were attacking, there was a lot of space in behind them. And I think, you know, when you've got players like Salah and Trent Alexander-Arnold, they've got so much pace and skill going forward that, you know, you give them an inch, they can just exploit that.
Yeah.
So I think there was a little bit of vulnerability there, but
I agree with that, but I also disagree at the same time, because, I mean, when you look at the way that their first goal came, it was
Liverpool.
Basically it was straight through the middle. And it did look, it was a bit Keystone Cops from us from a little bit there. I mean, there
lucky
was
bounce, didn't they?
Yeah, there was a couple of ricochets, which, well, I mean, it was, hang on, I've got it written down here. They brought it out and it was basically, it was trying to find Salah with the through ball, but it basically hit Dunk, then hit Webster and found himself into the path of Henderson.
Yeah.
He managed to find Salah who teed up Firmino. But
weirdly,
it was just sloppy. It was just really sloppy. When you look at their other goals, yeah. I mean, all three goals were preventable.
Yeah, but hang on, every fan will always say that the goals that we concede are sloppy. I actually thought the second one was actually pretty good. And let's face it, if that was us that scored it, we'd be purring over that. So I think that's a little bit harsh. And also the vision that Salah had, irrespective of whether he was offside, the vision that he had to actually try and tee his mate up, knowing full well he couldn't get the connection he wanted to get it past Sanchez. So he stuck it wide, which was a little bit hopeful. But, you know, we've seen him do that before. So it's just, yeah, you get the build-up for that first goal was a little bit Keystone Cops. The second goal, I've got to say, was a decent breakaway goal. And like I say, we'd be purring if it was us, I think.
I think, though, whilst the goals might have had an element of sloppiness, it was the momentum shift that was caused by that space. So they created chances from those wide areas. But our central defence had made a few clearances. Sanchez made a couple of good saves or caught the ball in the air as it came across. But there was kind of a bit of a momentum swing, probably around the 25-30 minute mark, that just, you know, Liverpool had finally worked out a little bit of what we were doing and found a way around it.
And did you notice, because under Potter, you'd notice that if he saw that kind of wave after wave, he'd do something about it. Did you notice De Zerbi do something about that?
I felt that we slowed a little bit. And I don't know whether that was maybe being a little bit leggy after having that just breathless first 20 minutes, because you can't keep that tempo or intensity up for a whole half. But we did seem to drop a little bit and take the pressure a bit more rather than go full out, in my view. But the system didn't really change, and his subs were more like for like in a way, you know, bringing Lallana on, it just added that same creativity in the middle that Gross kind of gives you. Bringing Lamptey on, you know, it's pace again, and
But I mean, bearing that in mind, I mean, we can't really comment too much because it's one game into the regime. But I mean, from what I've seen, the game largely passed Pascal by, which is unusual this season because he's been phenomenal so far. So, I mean,
they did a number on him.
Yeah, well, maybe, but it was like, when you see that the pace at which we were playing at, you know, the likes of, I mean, Pascal's pace is always
Pascal's
in his head.
No pace.
It's always in his head because he ain't got it in his legs.
Well, you have to remember, and this is something that Jurgen Klopp said after the game, and I think he got quite a bit of a bit of a bullying for it, a bit of a sort of grief for it. He said we didn't know how to set up because we don't know anything enough about them. Now, admittedly, he said it afterwards, but then he's not going to say it beforehand. But then, having said that, Tom, you've just said it. You know, I think we're all saying it. We don't know what to expect. We have a rough idea. We're hoping it's something that's Potter plus, maybe. But in the great scheme of things, De Zerbi in this country is an unknown quantity. So again, it's not unreasonable to say you don't know what to expect.
I would add, though, that that's actually been a Brighton trademark over the last couple of seasons, even with Potter, because except for the last 15 games or so, where it's been a relatively consistent team, going to a game, you're always going, we don't know what formation it's going to be. We don't know who that's going to be in the starting lineup. There's always been an element of surprise and the number of systems that he played and started with, that there's always been that. And I can't buy an argument that a top flight manager doesn't have a clue how to expect, because surely he's looking at Zerbi's previous teams as a clue as to how he could set up and presenting a number of options to the players. I mean, they're the best players in the world. They've got to be able to take that on.
And on the same measure, it's Liverpool, right? So, I mean, this is how far we've come. Usually, they wouldn't have set up to worry about us. They worry about what they're going to do. And
that's what hits the nail on the head for me, AD. Once upon a time, it's this is us. And here we are, albeit only 7 games in, but here we are sustaining a top 4 place. With all due respect, we should be 4-0 up against teams like Liverpool after 20 minutes. Tom was there, and it wouldn't have been undeserved. And here we are taking the fight, and probably again, the one team that we do fear is Manchester City, and apart from, frankly, given that there's actually now a bit of extra spice to it, it's about time we frankly beat Chelsea, and we've got that coming up soon. That there aren't any teams that we should be fearing. For those that watch Match of the Day, the message is finally getting in that actually we've got something going here.
Well, I am very, very concerned. I mean, if we play anything like we did at the back against Man City with Haaland and Form he's in, that is a worrying prospect.
Listen, if we can limit him to 2 goals, then I think we've done brilliantly. But the point we'll talk about the goals in a minute. But again, Tom, when we're talking about swings in play, once Liverpool got the lead, they backed off, didn't they? They slowed down.
And the difference was Matoma, because I think bringing Matoma on, you know, Estupiñán, I think, lost the pace of the game around the 60-minute mark. He was struggling to keep up going up and down. But once he brought Matoma on, suddenly he just went full pace at the Liverpool defence. And I think that just pushed them back that little bit deeper. Whereas they had set up in the second half a lot higher up the pitch and were starting their plays higher, actually just having that direct attacker instantly pushed their whole defence back and gave us that bit more confidence attacking. And I think they also wanted to protect that lead. So they weren't risking everything to go out and score again Because they knew there was a threat coming from us.
I mean, Tom, how much did you enjoy watching Carew leave Trent on his backside?
I mean, to be honest, you've got that and also Trossard leaving him on his backside, and I'm not sure which was better.
It wasn't. I mean, I know that Alexander Arnold's coming up under an awful lot of pressure from all sorts of places. You forget how old he is. I mean, he's still so young, and you know, that free kick he had was there. But I mean, we don't want to put the boot on him too much. But let's. Let's talk about the goals in this game that we did score. Obviously, all three from Leandro. And that first one, I mean, that the cross from Solly deep into the box to find Trossard, it was headed away by Alexander Arnold, but Alexis McAllister to get to that second ball and then play it into Solly, who then teed up Leandro. It was just team play. It was just delicious.
And the flick from Welbeck, I mean, that flick on from Welbeck is just world class. You know, no defence can play against that kind of play when the receiving player is on the line. You know, Leo has phenomenal footwork. So he created that space himself, and it was a hard finish.
Yeah. Well, all three goals were on his weaker foot as well.
Yeah.
Well, this is something that's, you know, still a little bit of a mystery to me about Trossard. Is, I mean, he's been with us for four seasons? Is his fifth, is it? Something like that. I lose track. And there are times when his build-up play can be absolutely astonishing, and he'll stick any right back on his backside. But there's other times where he's in a right position and his decision-making is just shocking. And I'd just love to know, we probably never will know, but being that fly on the wall, I'd love to know what it was that flicked that switch that's turned him from this, you know, sort of someone comes near him and his knee explodes. So this bloke who can't stop scoring, I'd just love to know what's happened there.
Confidence, that's what it is. And you've got to credit Graham
Potter.
Well, you've got to credit Graham Potter with a lot of that, because, and you know, he's done that. And the fact that Leo's been to the gym quite a lot, he's certainly bulked up a lot. And he's a lot harder to get off the ball. And like I said, Tom, it's confidence.
I think also it's where he's playing. He's playing through the middle more. So he's entering the box more direct onto goal rather than being out on the wing and having to work his way across. And I think that probably helps him as a player as well, getting in behind. You know, I think that's one of the big differences this season. The amount of times we're in behind the defence inside the box has been probably the most it's been since we're in the Championship.
Absolutely. So, you know, we've got his first goal and the way he finished his second as well. And again, some great build-up play. Again, the weird thing is, Ady, you know, you're saying about Liverpool's goals were sloppy from our point of view. I thought that all three of ours were sloppy from their point of view, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was Alexander Arnold again. I mean, the way that Welbeck just pinched the ball off him.
Well, yeah, tried to control it and made a pig's ear of it. There's Welbeck, who, incidentally, sorry, Tom, I've got to ask you this, or ask either of you, what on the name of all that's unholy is all about the elements on social media criticising Danny Welbeck for not scoring and for criticising his work rate? What on earth is that about?
He's one of the hardest working strikers we've ever had. And actually, I think calling him a striker is unfair, because you then automatically expect goals. He's not in the team to score a hatful of goals. He's in the team because of what he does on the pitch, his hold-up play, his ability to win possession back and to run that line and to scare those defenders. I mean, he
sets up everyone else, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Don't forget, he's probably the most decorated player ever to play for us. I mean, you look at his England caps, the goals he scored for England. The guy's just a legend. He's amazing.
Apart from Bobby Smith, but that doesn't count. But
yeah, well, that was just to settle the gambling debt, so we're not worrying about that.
Not that I've followed his career that closely, but surely one could argue he's in the form of his life. And like I say, the stats may not say that, but you watch. This is where you got lies, and damn statistics, because the stats don't actually say anything. Is when you see his work rate, And it's not just running around headlessly. It's very intelligent work the whole time.
And I mean, let's go back to Trossard. I mean, it was a great finish there, Tom. But I mean, Alisson's got to be questioning himself there, right?
Oh, the second goal for sure. He's just flapped at it, and you know, it's not great.
Can I also just say there's a type of goal that's being scored that I can think of three or four now recently, where it's not just so much the shot across the keeper, it's actually going into the side of the net, not that far from the goalpost. Was Caicedo's goal against Leicester, wasn't it? That was like that, shot across the keeper. He made a hash of it. I think it was Trossard scored like that, did he not, against Leicester as well? It's the way he's actually firing across. He's not aiming for the back of the net. He's just getting the ball over the line. And that's just the difference in the accuracy of the shooting. You don't have to score a worldie. Just get the ball into the net.
Okay, we talk about the equaliser, but we need to talk about the goal that gave Liverpool the lead, own goal from Adam Webster. And this was all about Big Bad Bob on this one, wasn't it? I mean, basically, he came flying out trying to punch it. Actually, having watched the highlights again, if he'd have just stayed where he was, he could have easily just gone like, ping and just caught it.
It was shades of Brezovan at Upton Park.
Remind me, please.
I had genuinely forgotten about that. Thanks, Tom.
Sorry. But, you know, I think, you know, it's easy to get upset about that. Thankfully, we got something from the game. But, you know, that save at the end of the game more than makes up for that error.
But, I mean, we talk about team goals. For me, probably not as good as the goal at Stoke from Guerrero. I was going to say like Pete the Pig then, but it was like that's his pet pig.
Of course, yeah. Sorry, yeah.
but that was still probably one of my all-time favourite Albion goals. But this goal, all 10 outfield players touched the ball in the move. It was just
Is that really
delightful?
And yet, probably the worst kick of it was the one that went in.
Well, no, that was the best because
he
basically
shanked it, didn't he?
No, he didn't shank it. Basically, he hit it into the ground, so it would go over the keeper.
I think that was
deliberate.
Think he
Tom
built it, and he mishit it.
It was a beautiful goal.
fair enough. Well, okay. Let's put it this way: it went in.
It did.
Yeah, and actually, my favourite part of the Liverpool game is the Derby's first game. 100% shots on target.
Was it really?
Yeah.
It wasn't his little bit of control on the touchline.
Obviously, I mean, who knows?
Okay, but I mean, the point at Anfield, I mean, we would have taken that before the game, but I mean, are we disappointed not to get all three? We are, aren't we? 2-0 up.
I think from 2-0 up, there is a slight bit of disappointment, but you know, it's a silly thing to say, but you know, we went 2-0 up too early.
You don't want to score too early. You don't want to score too early.
We go 4-0 up too early.
Try that one.
Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. Show as ever is brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And we've got a bit of a doozy of a shirt here, Tom. Can you describe it for me?
Yeah, it's a real looker. I think I described it.
You did.
it's quite a simple shirt. It's white. It's a Puma shirt, but you've got this interesting sleeve and collar section where it's like the star section of the American flag with blue background and white stars. In the middle, you've got this massive sponsor, which is a red square and some letters I can't quite work out. Around it, but yeah, I actually quite like this shirt.
If Evel Knievel played football, he'd play it in this.
Oh,
you
that
said
helmet
it's
would go with
it's
it.
About it's pretty noisy, this shirt. I'm gonna have a go at the sponsor here because there isn't really a badge. It looks like it's MIT is written down the side. The only thing I can think of with MIT is the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and then AU written across the top. So unless it's something golden about it, but is it the case, AD, that the stars are an obvious thing, that it is a USA team?
Where is Phil at the moment?
USA.
Yeah, so it's obviously not from USA. This is actually your shirt of the week. This is the 1989-1990 away shirt of Austrian side Admira Wacker Mödling. And they play in Zweiliga after relegation from the Austrian Bundesliga last season. Home is a 10,600 capacity Mürchen Invest arena in the town of Maria Endersdorf in the east of Austria. The original site was formed in 1905 as Admira Wien, and they merged with Wacker Wien in 1971. And then in 1997, they merged with VfB Mödling, and then in 2008 with SK Swarthof. With all of those merged teams, you might expect them to have an illustrious history. And they have been Austrian champions 9 times, cup winners 6 times, with the most recent was 1965-66 when they did the double. Since 2000, they've had 29 managers, which is probably reflected in the record of their yo-yo league swapping, lowly finishes, and various financial troubles over the last 22 years. Links to the UK are few and far between. Current Lewis forward, Gary Noel, spent a season with Varka in 2011-2012. But I did find a link to both the UK and the Albion. The last player to score a hat-trick for Brighton was a chap called Gordon Smith, and he spent the 86-87 season at Admira Wacker, or whatever they were called back then, making 38 league appearances and scoring 6 goals. It's funny we should mention Gordon Smith there, Al.
Yeah, because we had a natter with him today, didn't we?
Now, we are delighted to welcome a man who is probably best known for not scoring a certain chance in the 1983 FA Cup final. So it's easy to forget that he actually did have a brilliant Albion career that actually sees him sitting 7th in the Albion all-time top flight goal scoring list, and was, in fact, until last weekend, the last Brighton player to score a hat-trick in the top division. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome back to the Raw, Gordon Smith. Gordon, you're looking younger than both me and Al put together. How is that even possible?
I don't know. I must be a very good light that's on me, I think. That must be what it is.
AD, yeah. He is younger than you and me put together. That's why.
Well, this is true. I try to deny how old I am these days, but yeah.
How old are you, AD?
Huh?
How old are you, AD?
I'm 49 and a bit.
Believe me. Gordon, you're looking well, mate. What have you been up to lately?
Well, I'm working away. I've set up a new business recently there, which is... I brought it in from America. I've got the license for this guy. He invented this this test to identify the personality of people in order that you can actually know what goes on. And I've taken the license for Europe, and I'm going to introduce it into football in order to the football clubs can determine what each individual's like. Because I think for far too often in the game, and I've experienced it through my years in football, is that everybody's treated the same. And yet we're not the same. We're all very different personalities. And sometimes you don't get the best out of people because of how you speak to them, what they don't realise about themselves. So I'm going to be introducing this into football and coming times, although it's going to be for other occupations as well, not just for football.
I mean, I think that's something that here at Brighton, which we do already, I mean, particularly under the previous management, who had a degree in emotional intelligence, and it was all about finding the right characters and in recruitment. And so, I mean, I think that is something that we've certainly been doing, but I know other clubs don't follow that particular rule.
Sports science has become a big factor, Eddie. And what I'm saying is here that this one is America. I found out about it from someone who'd been working for them in the States. And found out the success it brings. It's a stage beyond even the current aspect of psychology, sports psychology. And I've spoken to some sports psychologists about it, and they're very impressed by it because it's different from anything we have before. And that's why I think it's unique. And that's why I think it's going to be very, very special in order to introduce it. It'll take a little while because there'll be a bit of cynicism about it. There's always is when you try to introduce anything new into football. There's always people who say, no, we don't need that. We don't want that. I know that very well.
I was going to ask you about that later, but we might as well do that now. Because, I mean, obviously, there's obviously, apart from being a Brighton player and playing for Man City and various other clubs in your career, you were also the chief executive of the Scottish FA. And
yeah,
during that particular time, you were coming up with all sorts of brilliant ideas, which are actually were laughed at at the time, some of them, but they're actually more commonplace these days. I mean, things you were doing with like things like dementia and bringing in retrospective action for like things like diving and stuff, which basically became VAR.
Well, that's right. I mean, we were the first. We actually, I got that through, and we were the first country in the world to bring in retrospective action for simulation, is the word they call it. We tried not to use the word diving because that was or cheating. That was the other one we tried not to use. So we brought that in. We got it in because I just felt it was becoming more and more common in the game. And it's something I find very annoying. I still, to this day, I don't understand why. See, with VAR we've got now. Now, this is true as well. I was in the FIFA and the UEFA football committee. And in 2009, I actually put forward the use of VAR. I didn't call it that in those days, but I said that the referee should get information immediately of people who can watch the replays of action and then do something about it in terms of when there's been a mistake made, his decision's not been correct. Now, I feel to this day it's still the same. Now, the people are watching VAR, they must be able to see the number of times you see a player going down as if he's badly hurt in a challenge, and then you see the replay right away, and you can tell he's hardly been touched or not even touched at times. Why does someone who's got the VAR right in front of him not put words in the referee's ear and say, that guy's cheated there, he's not been touched? Why can't they just immediately book them? And I think it would improve the behaviour. That's what I was trying to do, was trying to improve the behaviour of players in general. But it's quite interesting what you say, because it's even in the kids' games nowadays, because they see the professionals doing it, and a lot of the kids do it in kids' football.
Yeah, I was going to say, given the, you know, sort of like as AD put it, you came up with what effectively was the precursor to VAR. And as someone obviously still keen on football, what form, in your opinion, should VAR take, both in terms of the good aspects of it, the bits that supposedly work and the bits that don't work? I mean, do you see the technology as working okay? Do you see the application? Just give us an overview as to what you think of where it is now and where it should be.
Well, how I would see it is this, that I feel it takes far too long to make decisions. I think that the replay should be shown, and they should have another official, someone who is also a referee, should immediately, having seen the replay, give the referee a word in his ear exactly what his opinion is, and his opinion should be taken. Because if one of the officials in the sidelines, you know, the one of the other officials, what we used to call a linesman, actually sees something and then tells the referee this happened, he'll take his opinion on it. So why can't he take the opinion on somebody who's sitting watching the footage on television and watching replays? All he has to do is that. All this stuff when I'm going over to look at the screen, because you know now, we're all getting into the habit of knowing that, see, when a referee goes to look at the screen, he changes his decision, doesn't he? Every single time, it now becomes a different decision.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have seen a couple of times, Gordon, where they have actually like stuck with their original decision this season. But I mean, it has taken a while for that to actually happen.
Correct. But as I say, if you've got another official watching it, then the referee should be saying, should be just basically principle should be that person is looking at the footage of it, and he now makes a decision on what's happened and what the decision should be, tells the referee, and the referee complies with that. Now, if it's looked at later on and it found it's a mistake, then the person who has looked at the VAR is the person who should be in trouble, not the referee, because he's actually told him what to do. And then things would happen a lot quicker and the game would flow a lot more easily. And I'm still a great believer in VAR as the right thing for the game, because we do want to see it. And I'll tell you why. You know, this is the honest truth. The first time that I brought it forward in order to put this to the committees of UEFA and FIFA was at the time, do you remember when Thierry Henry handled the ball for France?
Against Ireland,
and they knocked Ireland out, Republic of Ireland out of the World Cup because of it. That was the case I brought up to say, I'm like millions of people sitting at home watching that and could tell that goal should have been disallowed. Why could the referee not be told just right away by someone watching the TV footage? That was why I brought it. I felt it should be brought in. But at that time, it got rejected. Yeah. I actually put it forward and everybody said, oh, we don't want this. that this is not takes away from the game. They said it's, the game's all about controversy and discussion. I said it's not about controversy and discussion when actually there's footage to show it. So if there's no cameras at a game, you can have a great argument afterwards about what the situation was. But if there's cameras there, 90% of the time, we already know what happened.
Yeah.
Do you also feel that there's an air of politics? And I don't mean party politics here, but I mean in as much as like the referees will almost close shop on each other, where if someone says, you want to have a look at this, this has happened. And like you said, in virtually every case, they will actually go and change their mind. And yet you can see that, you know, this is not the mind to be changed. Or even when VAR does get it wrong, and again, there's been instances of that. And if you remember, yeah. AD, the Southampton penalty, which, you know, VAR clearly showed was outside, but they still gave it. So, Gordon, is there an element that you think there's got to be a bit more sort of openness to this as well at the same time that it's not the closed shop that the referees want it to be?
Yeah, I think so. I think it has to be open. But I think, you know, the referees are the people who are actually making the decision on the day. And therefore, it's very important they get that decision and they take responsibility for it. And they say the responsibility normally is the person on the field who's doing it. But if there's a decision which is to be counteracted by someone watching it on a screen and watching a replay, then fine. And I still think that then automatically that decision should be made by that person who's watching the replay. It shouldn't be a case of, you know, oh, I don't agree with you, I'm going to have to look at it and all that sort of thing. Why bother with that? As I say, the responsibility then becomes on the person who's actually now making the decision, which is the person who is working for VAR. We don't need three and four people doing it as sometimes we understand they do have, like a pool of people watching it. That's not required.
You know, it does seem, though, that it does seem to work a lot smoother across the continent than it does here in England. And it's I don't know what the reason for that is. But
they can pick up a clear and obvious error a lot quicker, whereas here I think they're just going to go to the minutiae of it. I mean, there's one aspect of it I think I probably might end up disagreeing with you a little bit here, Gordon, if that's okay with you, is that for me that football is a human game and therefore that human error is actually part and parcel of it. And should we therefore have perfection? Because if nothing else, it takes away the old tradition of the good old rant in the pub afterwards.
Yeah.
But with that in mind, and given that the laws of the game do say in the opinion of the referee, because if you then get two referees looking at it, you're going to come up with two different opinions. Three, I mean, it's because it's not refereeing by committee. If at which point I would ask in your hypothesis, Gordon, does the decision get taken away from the person who should be making all the final decisions?
Yeah, I think that the person should be making it, but I think when there are circumstances, and that's why I'm so much in favour of it, when there are circumstances where the person who's making the decision doesn't see it properly, doesn't get the correct angle on what he's seen, and therefore someone else gets looking at replays which can correct that mistake, that's fine. Now, in general, there'll be mistakes made, all, but I think in terms of crucial decisions, like that's the most important thing. Crucial decisions, which could be an ordering off, a goal, a free kick leading to a goal. These are the ones, in my opinion, a penalty kick, as I said before. Yeah. They're the ones for me that are crucial because they turn games. And therefore, that's why I wanted to see them with more options than not. Say, it's even 90% of the time that we get the correct, maybe even more than that, 95% of the time we've got the correct decision, other than the fact that I know that that's what people's argument was. It's a great debate in the pub later on, what happened and all that. But no, it's not a great debate in the pub if you've got clear footage to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's going to rage on and on, Gordon. I mean, let's face it. I mean, how many goals will you have been have taken off you from with the offsides? And that will give you a different view on it. But you know,
don't forget, sorry, one, AD.
Never ever offside, never.
Yeah. And the thing is, Gordon, because the VAR thing, and it's something which is very pertinent to us at the moment, because obviously we had there was arguments about the Liverpool goal, first goal at the weekend. Yeah. There was we would have been having this conversation with you 4 weeks ago if Alexis McAllister's like thunderbolt would be allowed.
Can I just
count.
Point out here, AD, there's two massive parts of the offside law that were in place when Gordon was playing that aren't there now. One, is that you had to be behind the defender to be level was to be offside.
Yeah.
And two was that it didn't have to be the ball go to the receiving person. It could be anyone who's on the far side of the pitch and not interfering with player at all. When, right. you know, someone on the far side of the left wing and everything's happening down the right wing, if that person on the left up goes the flag. Right. So, you yeah. know, it's two massive parts of it.
That's a good point. That was an improvement in terms of the laws of the game, was the fact that, you know, as you said, that someone who's not interfering with play shouldn't be ruled offside because a goal scored. Now, I can think of one or two incidents I had in that case where I got a goal, but somebody else would happen to be offside and the goal was disallowed. And the one you're talking about, McAllister's goal, that was a fantastic goal. And I still think that was a mistake to rule that out.
Goal of the season.
I still argue with that. I think the referee got that wrong. I didn't agree with it at all.
Yeah,
but therein lies the point, isn't it? It's VAR getting it wrong in this instance because the technology just if the technology isn't good enough, it shouldn't be used. I mean, clearly, goal line technology, when it's there and it's instant, fine. I don't think anyone has a problem with assuming it's working properly and they've switched the switch on, you know, and it's instant and immediate. But then again, with that one, the ludicrous situation of okay, Mwepa was technically offside and. You know, it's you then go back to the referee to say, okay, in your opinion, was he interfering? You know, was he trying to get the ball? And, you know, you think, is this offside or is this calamity?
I know what you mean. And because he wasn't involved in respect to the fact that he didn't even stop the defender making the clearance. The defender made the clearance of the ball. And then, so you're then ruling out the fact that he had any influence whatsoever on the incident. And then, Castle scores a great goal. I agree with you.
Okay. Well, let's go back into the mist of time. In fact, it was actually 42 years ago this week, to the 4th of October, 1980. And we were 3-0 down at Highfield Road, Gordon. What happened?
It was 3-0 down, and I think it was 18 minutes to go. We were 3-0 down. And then I just happened to get a hat-trick that day. So Just happened to. My only hat-trick for... My only hat trick for Brighton, to be fair, but it was a special day. But it was quite funny because after the game, I got the match ball, and I was sitting in the dressing room. And Alan Mullery came over and went, he says, "Well done, Smudger." And I was like, "Thanks." And he goes, "You don't look too happy." And I said, "I'm still annoyed at my header being cleared off the line in the last minute. I had a header."
is that what happened?
I beat the goalkeeper in the last minute, and a defender cleared it off the line. So that would have been four. Now, to have scored four goals in 18 minutes would have been pretty good, I think. But
it was over the line. Goal line technology said so.
Yeah.
Okay, Gordon, let's test your memory on that because I've got Tim Carter's book up in front of me. Can you remember who else played alongside you that day?
Probably most of them. Brian Horton would be playing, John Gregory, Gary Williams, Steve Foster.
No.
Graham Mosley in goals, Peter Ward and Mick Robinson up front. Yeah. Did Peter O'Sullivan play that?
Sully didn't play, no.
Did he not?
I know Ray McHale was on the bench.
Was he?
He was the substitute.
He wasn't.
According to the program.
Yes, he was. Sorry, I'm looking at the wrong commentary game. number 11.
A lot of people think, still to this day, people think I was a striker. I mean, I was quite pleased. I got my midfield. I was a midfield player, so I was happy to get my three. I only scored two hat tricks in my career. One was for Rangers and the other one was for Brighton.
Yeah. Have you still got the match balls?
No, I don't think I've got the match ball anymore. I don't know what happened to that.
Eddie, the number 11 you missed out was, it wasn't Sully, it was Neil McNabb.
Oh, Neil McNabb played that day, did he? Yeah.
Right. There's a brilliant website, Gordon, called Seagulls Programmes, which is run by a good friend of ours, Ian Hine. And it's an online gallery of pretty much every Brighton program from the year dot to the current day. And I was having a look through there, and I saw there was a thing that for that season, for every away goal that we scored, Bob Mulholland from Mulholland's off license in Church Road in Hove was donating a bottle of champagne. So that presumably meant you got three bottles of champagne from him.
I don't remember that either. I think it's quite funny because there's been three hat tricks for Brighton at the highest level. Peter Ward, myself, and now Trossard as well. And the thing about it is, the three of them are all away from home.
I mean,
Wolves I'm against.
You see, Alexis McAllister, we've forgotten about him again. That was at the Amex. It was a hat trick.
Yeah, would have been.
But okay. Oh, let's talk about the current Brighton team, Gordon. I mean, do you keep an eye out on what they're doing at the moment?
Oh, absolutely. Watch every game I can. My little grandson, because my daughter was born in Brighton, so my little grandson is still a big fan. Little Zabby, and he watches all the games too. So we're very much into it. And I think it's been great to watch Brighton of late. You know, I think they really, I think Potter had them going to a very, very high degree, and they play well. They work hard for each other, and they do cause teams problems. No doubt about that. One of the big problems they did have, I felt, even last season, was they just didn't have an actual goal scorer. Really, somebody banging in a lot of goals that would have taken them to another level. But nevertheless, they were still a hard team to play against, and it's great to see how they're doing this season. And although he's away, I mean, that's a great start for the new boss. I mean, he's got a good reputation. The new manager's come in, and hopefully that's off to a great start there by getting a very good point at Anfield.
Yeah, it was, under Graham, I mean, this is something that I've had these conversations with some Chelsea fans recently. And with Graham, it took him 3 years to actually get the team scoring goals on a regular basis, and they didn't really start to click on that front until probably the Arsenal game last season. Which coincided with Moises Caicedo coming into the team as well, possibly. But it was he's a project manager, and it takes a while for it to happen. So I mean, he's probably not going to get the time that he wants or needs at Chelsea. So, but obviously the Derby's come in. And it's going to be flying by the seat of the pants time, I think.
Oh, definitely. I think that, you know, as I say, it's always difficult. Every manager comes in, a new manager is always a very, very hard position to come into, because especially if the team's been going well. Do you know what I mean? It's like you look back at David Moyes, had done fantastically well at Everton, got the Manchester United job, and then look what happened there from, because he just didn't get the response from the players, because the players respond at times in terms of how the manager is, what sort of tactics he puts forward, his training sessions and all that. And if they don't necessarily agree with you, it's that old adage of losing the dressing room. And I've seen it happen a lot, that the certain managers do that. The players don't respond. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Graham Potter had done a fantastic job. So it'll be interesting to see if the players then can carry on with it. If they've got the right ambition and the right motivation, they will. Even under a new manager, they will. But you never know, in terms of what his tactics are, in terms of how he runs things, whether the players will ultimately respond in the right manner. Because, as I say, every managerial appointment is a risk. Oh.
But one question I did want to ask you, and you don't have to answer this one if you don't want to. But I mean, obviously, last time we spoke to you, and that show is still in our archives, and that particular incident at Wembley is well documented.
We promised they wouldn't. We promised. But
I mean, in that show, you said you used to go onto all the FIFA committees and everything, and you famously said I was the only person I didn't know in the room. But I mean, when you look at that, you saw the inner workings of these FIFA committees and how things work. So how surprised were you when they awarded the World Cup to a country that has no football tradition and is in hostile conditions for playing football in?
Well, there's two sides to it. One was, I did agree with it. No. It was a surprise, not greatly, when you consider a lot of what was going on in the game, in terms of there was no doubt about it. There was corruption in the background, in terms of people who were getting basically getting rewarded for their voting. And I think they already found that out in the States. Even the FBI came in, and that's why the Swiss organisations had to come into it, because normally they wouldn't have done anything about it. But FIFA had to come in, and people lost their jobs because of it. There was a lot going on there. But I was quite surprised that they never took it off Qatar after that, because of what they found out, what was going on. And it's the same thing about, in terms of the actual, I mean, you look at the country there. I mean, normally they get even at their games, the normal crowds at their matches, their league matches and all that, are about 300-350 people. Now, one of the things, they're building stadiums there, and my understanding is when the World Cup's over, these stadiums are getting taken down and transferred to other countries for other people to have, because they don't need them. They don't need the stadiums, and they don't have the the infrastructure there for the training. They'll build all this because they have mega money, and it's all down to mega money that they have got this World Cup. Mm. And it's quite funny because I was criticised quite heavily. I remember when it got awarded, I came out and I did an interview on it because I'd been in UEFA and FIFA, and I said, it won't be a summer World Cup, this. And I was criticised heavily about it. Said, imagine Smith saying there's not going to be a summer World Cup because it's always in the summer, you know. And then what happened? Here we go, winter World Cup. Because I forecast it, because I said, no, you couldn't play over there. You know, you couldn't play in that time of year because they said, oh, there's going to be air-conditioned stadiums and all that. But it's not air-conditioned for the people who are having to spend their time there in the summer, all the supporters on a day-to-day basis. Mm. So I just felt that it was a strange one to take it to Qatar.
AD, Gordon, imagine the city of Leeds, and imagine there's six football stadiums in Leeds. That's the spread of the Qatar World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah. I know, and all the support, all the fans who are going over, they'll be in each other's face all the time as well. And
there's not enough hotels. They all got to stay on cruise ships. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I know.
And it's like, but okay. Anyway, just before we close, I mean, Gordon, when was the last time you went out for dinner with Paul McCartney?
Last time I saw Paul McCartney was almost 4 years ago. I got to I met somebody who was dealing with our security, and they got in touch with me and said, Paul's leaving you two tickets for the concert. I haven't known him. And then a week before the concert, I got an email to say, Paul wants to meet you. So I went in and met him at the Hydro in Glasgow before the show. And he had a good laugh because he said, I remember you being in my house, all that. And I said, we certainly did. And I said, last time I was with you, you sang to me. And I said, I'm going to sing to you. I said, there's only 15 more days I can sing this song. And he went, when I'm 64.
because you didn't actually realise whose house you were in when you were playing the guitar in the lounge, did you?
No, he played to me. He played the guitar to me. And thank goodness it was a lucky aspect because I said I played guitar and he said, what songs? And I mentioned Blackbird. He went out, brought his guitar in, sat down and sang Blackbird to me, you see. And what happened was, a lucky thing was, because he's left-handed, he couldn't give me the guitar to play. And when he finished playing, he said, is that how you play it, Gordon? I went, a bit better than that, Paul, but that was actually okay, you know?
Oh, that don't believe it.
So, how impressive is that? So, Gordon, just to finish off, when are you next in town?
I don't know when I'll be down. I know I'm definitely coming down next May. We have a 40-year anniversary of the Cup final next May.
That's trolling, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll be down for that. And I'll be coming down once again to apologise to everybody. All my former teammates and all the supporters. Yeah. I apologise once again for my miss.
Are you still maintaining it was a world class save and not a bad miss?
No, it was okay as a save, but it was still a bad miss. I should have scored.
Right, on your knees.
Yeah. And on that note, we'll leave it. So thank you so much for your time, Gordon. It's been lovely chatting to you. Hopefully we'll speak to you again soon.
Pleasure, guys. All the very best.
So lovely to hear from you. It was his third appearance on the Roar, actually. So,
and each one in a different location. No, that we were referring to earlier, where it was on Keith Emerson's keyboard. That was quite the palaver. I'm not going to tell the story because it's actually too boring. But we ended up recording it in a Worthing studio, which is now
the factory.
I think
it's the factory live now.
That's it. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I think the main thing I remember about that, as well as chatting to a very nice fellow, is that they gave us free access to all the drums and guitars and basses, and we never took them up on it. So,
well, Gordon did. Yes. He just picked up and played everything. Yes, but okay, well, we're running out of time, so quickly, we've got to look forward to the weekend, Tom. Spurs are the visitors to the Amex. They're coming by coach. Most other people are coming by skateboard, I think, with another train strike restricting people. It's going to be a sellout, so it's going to be interesting to see how people are going to get there. Answers on the postcard, please. Two Italian managers going head-to-head, probably... the traditional Italian manager against the new breed, Tom.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be fascinating. And I think our performance at Liverpool would have definitely given some food for thought, and especially Spurs coming off of the back of their loss to Arsenal. I mean, I think they're there for the taking again. Our home form is so much better now. we're a force to be reckoned with. And I think, you know, just keep on the same track. No trainer joke intended there. But, you know, I think if we keep it simple, keep doing what we're doing, we can go into any game with the chance of a win.
Yeah, you should know we rail against that sort of thing here, Tom, but it's...
Stop it!
That's one strike for me, right?
Yeah. Just keep chugging along. Keep chugging along. I'm steaming about the whole thing, to be honest. But anyway, but yeah, I mean...
I've a bunch of fives ready for you. I have a bunch of fives. Okay. So if Spurs are there for the taking, I mean, and as AD said earlier on, third place beckons. I think really in the excitement of what we've got, and here we are, fourth place, we've drawn away at Liverpool, Tom, we've got to still, I think, pinch ourselves a little, hold ourselves back a little bit and have this notion of walking before we can run. Because all this talk of, hey, going into third, it's all a bit fanciful, isn't it?
We're not talking about that, really, are we, Tom?
No, I agree. I think, you know, I'd still be happy with a draw. Saturday, always happy when you play one of these so-called big sides to just get anything. You know, it'll be a hard game, but we've got an opportunity there. It's another free hit, effectively, and we'll go in with confidence, and hopefully the crowd gets behind them, gives De Zerbi a good welcome to Falmer, and we get a good result.
Are you surprised that Eves isn't playing for him? Eves Bissouma?
Not hugely, because Conte is quite a conservative manager. So I think, you know, his recruitment in the summer was more about depth. I think I was surprised that he came out and publicly called out Bissouma for his inability to get the tactical side for Spurs. But, you know, Basuma's a good player and he did great for us. But
does seem a bit strange when you consider who his last manager was and the tactical instructions he had to take on about seven times a game. For Conte to come out and say that is baffling, because he's probably more tactically aware than he is.
Yeah, and to be honest, I was just surprised he went to Spurs of all teams. I thought he could have gone to a different team, but you know, ultimately, I think whether he plays or not, I hope he's on the losing side.
I think we all hope that, Tom. Well, that is all we've got time for. So thank you so much to Tom Hylands, to Alan Wears, of course, to Gordon Smith. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you all again next week. Bye.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird, fly. Blackbird, fly. Into the line of a dark black night. Black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise. You were only waiting for this moment to arise.